See Rome Vault Podcast, episode number 376. Monday, September 7th, 2020. Labor Day in the United States.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, See Rome Vault subscribers. So, taking a break from the audiobook, here's a conversation with Jim, your ad attacker, host of the Attack Ads podcast. So I'm going to say very, very little to set this up, and I'm not even going to play the whole interview for you. Here is the first hour, or at least the first hour's worth of content, after I cut out a lot of line noise and inhalations of breath and things that sounded terrible because of some vocal leveling I had to do. It was a pain, but for you, it results in a tighter podcast. Anyway, I'm going to play the first hour of it. Before I do, let me just give you a few pieces of information, which presented this way are absolute trivia, unconnected to anything else. But if you just keep them kind of floating around the front of your brain, you know, in front of your consciousness, you will have opportunity to slot this information into the structure that Jim and I are about to construct here in our conversation. So fentanyl is an opioid used as a pain medication and together with other medications for anesthesia. Fentanyl is also used as a recreational drug, often mixed with heroin or cocaine. It has a rapid onset and its effects generally last less than 2 hours. Medically, fentanyl is used by injection, nasal spray, skin patch, or absorbed through the cheek, transmucosal, as a lozenge or tablet. Fentanyl was first synthesized in Belgium by Paul Janssen, under the label of his relatively newly formed Janssen Pharmaceutical in 1959. It was developed by screening chemicals similar to pethidine or meperidine for opioid activity. And the word griefer, noun. In an online game or community, a person who harasses or deliberately provokes other players or members in order to spoil their enjoyment. Alternate definition, a griefer or bad faith player is a player in a multiplayer video game who deliberately irritates and harasses other players within the game, using aspects of the game in unintended ways. And now, armed only with those two bits of disconnected data, I subject you to my most recent conversation with Jim, your ad attacker. I am joined by Jim, your ad attacker. Jim, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Say, last I checked, Vermont was on fire. Things better now?
What was going on?
Well, you looked out your window and saw ash falling. I thought it was snowing.
I don't know that I ever found out what was happening.
Yeah, sometimes you look out your window and weird stuff happens.
So, Jim, ad attacker, somewhat south of Seattle. Is that where you are?
Somewhat in Seattle.
But, what am I thinking of? I thought you lived south of town.
Well, I grew up down there. But, no, once I moved to the UW and wandered around these fascinating and foreign things called sidewalks, I decided I wanted. So as soon as I could, I moved to town.
All right. So narrowing down the context for this conversation, 2020. Wow. Crazy.
Yeah. Who'd have thunk, man?
Yeah. You know, my prediction at the end of 2018 was that all of 2019 would feel like an election year, and it did. But 2020, an actual election year, doesn't feel like an election year.
It's a good thing they got that out of the way first.
Yeah. So perhaps we should start with the election.
We could do that. Thoughts? You mean the one that started in 2019?
Yeah, well, the one that started like 5th of November 2016.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah.
So any thoughts on the primary process?
Well, the primary is suffering from the same disease that COVID has brought to everyone. You need people gathered together to listen to a stump speech or a speech at the back of a train or a speech on a porch. You don't get that with Zoom. I mean, I'm happy talking with you, KMO, but I can't see one-on-one conversations with 3 million plus population of America. You need that feeling of gathering together and doing something together. There's a bookstore near my house called The Third Place, and it's based on some French philosopher's conjecture that you have three places that you absolutely need in your life: your home, your work, and a third place. Well, campaign season used to be entertainment. It's where people went to experience a bit of the third place. And now with Zoom, I don't even care what happens. I don't know if you feel the same way.
It never even occurred to me to try to check out either of the, you know, the major party conventions conducted, not exactly via Zoom, but, you know, not, it wasn't a gathering.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was a, from all accounts, a pair of very silly sort of, I don't know, variety shows. But
exactly. I saw the highlights of some of them on some of the late night shows, and, you know, jokes were, of course, made because they were deserved. they were fairly horrible, and I understand that nobody's ever done this in U.S. history. I don't know. It's just, it has taken all the excitement out of the entire process, and I just don't care.
Well, I haven't cared since Super Tuesday.
You're way ahead of me.
Yeah. I mean, Super Tuesday, everybody except Elizabeth Warren got their arms twisted to drop out and endorse Joe Biden.
And they left Warren there as a spoiler.
Yep. Warren stayed in for one more day to divide the progressive vote on Super Tuesday. And then she dropped out and endorsed Biden. And, you know, prior to COVID, I thought there's absolutely no way Joe Biden could finish the campaign season. He just doesn't have the wherewithal. He doesn't have the constitution to, you know,
adhere. The presence of mind.
Yeah, well, presence of mind, certainly. But even, you know, even if he were lucid, I didn't think that he had the stamina to endure, you know, the campaign schedule. And, well, he hasn't had to.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yes, I was reading just another one of those Upton Sinclair books, and I believe it was James Garfield ran what they called a front porch campaign. So essentially, the oil interests and some other interests funded Garfield's campaign. All he did was sit in his front porch, and reporters came to him. So he didn't have to do anything. He had the funding that he could steal the election and allow the guys to eventually create the teapot dome scandal. But he just stayed on his front porch. Joe needs that, and he got it through COVID.
Yeah. And he's being given kid glove treatment by the corporate media.
Well, of course. I mean, the corporate media would really love to have Trump in there, because Trump drives anxiety and rage drives money. That's their job. Fill the commercials with something that keeps them glued to the commercials. And they, if they don't get Trump, because, you know, national backlash and protests and burnings and whatever, Biden will work. He's good for a gaffe. And neither of those candidates is going to threaten their bottom line. That's the real bottom line to the whole thing.
That's, I think, the most important thing, is that now that the primary threat on the DNC side has been taken care of, the powers that be, much as I hate that phrase, don't care. They don't care. Either way, they're fine.
Yep, they will sell commercials. They will sandwich stuff together and make more commercials. They will make content that works with commercials. And none of the content will contradict the commercials. All is well with the world.
Yes. And Jeff Bezos will be richer at the end of the year than he is right now. And he's richer now than he was at the beginning of the pandemic, as are many billionaires. It's been a very good year for the billionaires.
Wait, what time is it? 1:47 Pacific. I think he's just gotten richer.
Yeah.
Just checking the ticker. Oh, I know. The entire economy is collapsing, and they're getting wealthy because of the CARES Act. And I was just listening to an interview, which a guy I highly recommend. he was talking about how the CARES Act had so much crap stuffed into it that not even the progressive Democrats knew what was in it until billionaires started complaining about airlines making out when they should go bankrupt. And there's stuff in there directing the Federal Reserve to maintain the price of stocks. And so speculators are giving in there and raising the price of stocks. And there's stuff in there about home values. And it's just a crazy world now. People can't even afford to live. There are several places sitting empty and abandoned, just sitting on the market waiting for the right price. And the homeless population is out of control. It is so weird.
Yeah.
So weird.
So I got a 5,000 word email from Chad Hill, the author of the Hip Crime Vocab blog. And I can't summarize it all, but, you know, he said a bunch of things that are factually accurate and that I agree with. But he kept coming back to, if you look at all this, how can you not see collapse? For me, if collapse doesn't involve the electricity grid going down, if it doesn't involve the loss of the internet, if millions of people, if most people can live through the collapse and not even see that it's happening, then that's not the collapse I care about.
Right.
So I'm just not.
We're talking about a breakdown of a current system and not a breakdown of life as we know it.
Exactly. And, you know, the current system needs to break down.
The whole Thomas Homer Dixon catabolic collapse scenario. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Thomas Homer Dixon has backed away from, you know, the predictions and the analysis of the book, The Upside of Down.
You know, that's unfortunate, because that book was really well done and it didn't come to any hasty conclusions.
Right. It was a sober book.
It was.
Yeah.
I especially loved, and for people who haven't read The Upside of Down, he spends, how would you say, 15 pages following a keystone in the Colosseum and calculating how much energy would it take to carve that out of the quarry, to dress them, to put it on a cart, to have it hauled the 75 miles from the quarry to the Colosseum, to have it dressed, to have it hoisted in place, and how much wealth would that require in simple terms of farmland to feed both the workers and the oxen that hauled the cart. It's like, it went deep into this, and it's like, excellent. This is a really good way of thinking about just one piece of what we know to be the Colosseum and how much effort it takes to build it.
Yep.
Now, once the framework for that collapsed, then Rome was in trouble. They couldn't expand into new farmlands. Okay, they were in trouble. This is a little different. This is, we still got lots of energy. In fact, we're using less of it than we always have, because we can't drive and fly. Well, you can't fly safely. Therefore, we're going to be washed in all kinds of petroleum, and the price is going to go down, and people are going to benefit until they don't. Lather, rinse, repeat.
Yep. I've taken in the audiobook version of George Friedman's new book, and the title is not leaping to mind, but it is about two cycles that he tracks, historical cycles. One he calls the institutional cycle. He says it's an 80-year cycle, and it's in it. The institutional cycle usually begins or ends with a major war, and, you know, at the transition between one cycle and the next, you get a sort of phase shift between one governmental paradigm and the next. And then there's a socioeconomic cycle, which is a 50-year cycle. And the two cycles they've never overlapped before. They've never come to an end and began at the same time.
Mm.
And they are almost overlapping. They're both ending in the late 2020s, and, you know, a new cycle is beginning late 2020s, early 2030s.
Wow.
Yeah. So he says, you know, mainstream books like his, they are written a year before they're published.
Right.
So it's not, you know, really drilling down on the details of the moment right now. So he doesn't know about COVID-19, you know, in the book. But he's talking about the 2020 and 2024 elections, and he's basically saying it doesn't matter who wins. Both sides are going to be attempting to maintain the previous institutional model, which is a technocratic model, and the previous socioeconomic model. I don't know if he has a name for, you know, our current socioeconomic paradigm, but he says both of them are you know, the 2020 is the last hurrah for both, and it's going to be a really rough decade. Ah, yes, the title of the book is The Storm Before the Calm.
And this is George Friedman?
Yeah, pretty sure
I've never heard of him.
Oh, well, he's much hated by many a C-Realm listener because he's an immigrant from, I think Romania, some Eastern European country. And, you know, he moved to the U.S. with his family as a young child, and he thinks the United States is pretty cool. You know, having moved here from a communist country.
Yeah, he hasn't been here long enough. Familiarity breeds contempt.
Not in his case.
Okay.
He lives in Texas and...
Wow.
Yeah.
And he still likes it?
He still likes it.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't insult Texans like that.
I know some really cool people who live in Texas.
I've met a few people who speak lovingly of their new home in Washington.
They're from Texas.
They're
all right. So let's speak of Washington. Washington
okay.
State. I'll say it. I've said it a million times, and I'll say it again. I'm not interested in the whole woke, you know, critical race theory, everything's about racism narrative. To me, that is just vile, ugly distraction away from critically important economic matters and class-based matters.
Well, let me jump in right now, Camo, and agree with you wholeheartedly.
Okay, so from one class essentialist to another, because that's a new term to discount and negate the validity of the viewpoint that you and I would probably articulate.
Oh, that's a good word. I like that.
Which one? Class essentialism?
I like that, yeah.
Oh, you don't spend much time on Twitter, do you?
Oh, no, I have a life.
Okay, right. You ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a class essentialist.
I haven't done anything on Twitter, you mean?
Yeah. So the anti-class essentialists demonstrated the efficacy of their model and their tactics in seizing part of Capitol Hill. For a time, it was the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ, and then it was the, Capitol Hill Occupied Precinct? Was that
Now my wife and I were very upset about the change in the names because, All right. You're in the autonomous zone and you're on Capitol Hill, and you lived here in Seattle long enough to know that Capitol Hill is the homosexual enclave. Chaz sounds gay.
Yes. Chop, not so much.
Chop sounds like somebody wants to be in a biker gang.
Yeah.
And we were just like, Chaz was such the perfect title. This is wonderful. We have a friend who is in her 80s who lives right in there, and she loved it. She said it was just like the 60s. It was vibrant. There was positive energy. There was really nothing bad happening that was, I guess the press would find bad things to happen just to make sure that they happened. But this is a woman on a walker. She was did not feel threatened in any way. Beyond her accounts, we did not even care to look at any of the news regarding the choppers or the chazzies or whatever you want to call them.
The Chapistanis is the phrase I heard.
I would accept Chazistanis.
Chazistanis.
That would be cool. Chop, I don't know. What are you thinking, Capitol Hill people? I mean, you're on Capitol Hill. You're occupying an area that just screams Chaz. Just embrace it. You know what I mean?
Well, too late. It's gone.
Well, it's gone. The whole thing is gone. The police chief has resigned. Whatever, you know. The whole issue of should we have the police that we have, should they be armed as they are armed, should they be outfitted as they are outfitted, is just facing huge distraction by people who are either overreaching in one direction to maintain the military presence of an occupying force or to get rid of it. There's a huge dialogue in there that people could be having. By the way, I hate the word dialogue. There's a huge discussion in there that people should be having about why don't we have social workers pay visits to people with mental problems and addiction problems as opposed to break down their doors.
Right.
There's a huge problem with, of course, the homeless population being most of them in need of a stable environment with medical care, which was phased out during the Reagan administration. And the response has been to lock them up. And until they're locked up, they can't find work because no one would hire them.
Right. If I ran a business, I certainly wouldn't hire somebody who you know, didn't have their life enough together to have an address, you know, or a clean pair of clothes, or
exactly.
You know, it's not that I'm heartless. It's just that I'm not made of money. And if I hire somebody to do something, I need a reasonable level of confidence that it's going to get done competently.
Exactly. And sadly, the kind of disabilities with the mental, the kind of insane in the membrane that won't get you a job is not the kind of developmental disabilities. I mean, there's plenty of support for folks who were born without the ability to get past the third grade. And they are, I have a neighbor, she goes to work, when she goes to work, and she works, she's in her 40s now, she can't even sign her name well, but she does fine. There's plenty of support for that. For the more developmental, the stuff that comes on later and later leads to addiction, there's not a lot of support. And it is sucky.
You know,
I guess these are the people I see at one point doing the destinationless bus rides.
Right. So I've been saying a lot of things this year, last year, to piss off the Blue Tribe.
What?
Yeah. But I have a few things in my arsenal that piss off the Red Tribe as well. And one of them is that given the structure of our society, running on, you know, fossil fuels and transitioning to other forms of energy, you know, believe that or not, with mechanization, fossil fuels, automation, we just don't need as much labor as we used to.
Ding, 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 ding. Yeah. Good answer.
And it doesn't make any sense to spend $200 to make somebody who's not really useful as a worker pretend to do something productive that might generate $50 worth of, you know, economic benefit.
I would say that your metrics may be accurate in the moment. Whether or not they would be accurate in the long term depends upon analyzing the tax structure and the tax incentives for employers. So I've been thinking about this one a lot. We really need to change the tax structure. Of course, because the very wealthy have taken over and are now instigating the changes they need through their elected representatives that they pay for, they have no way to feel my wrath.
Right.
Or necessarily to hear my good ideas. But you're right. It's like we don't need somebody to work 8 hours a day when really, according to John Maynard Keynes, as I talked about in a previous visitation on the Sea Realm, they only need to work 15 hours a week. And I think there's a lot of fear for what happens when people don't have to work full time. And I think we're seeing it now play out in the demonstrations. I think the wealthy understand that we got to put people to work just to stop things like CHOP.
So from my perspective, you know, I don't know if Seattle is laid out quite the way it was, you know, in terms of where the homeless congregate, but Pioneer Square was a place you just didn't go when I lived there, unless you were homeless and you wanted to go and drink and do other drugs and, you know, carouse with the other homeless.
And okay.
Maybe it's changed. But,
No, it hasn't. Right. No, it's spread.
I know Red Tribers who say, okay, we can give those people a roof and a bed and some food if they go through the motions of pretending to work 8 hours a day. But they don't have any sort of work ethic. They don't have any sort of, you know, they're just not wound very tight. They're
exactly.
Not going to do anything productive.
No, they have addiction problems. You don't do well in a job with addiction problems.
Right. So I have no problem paying for a roof and a bed and some food and maybe some addiction treatment. But here's another thing that pisses off the Red Tribe. There's a lot of people who are addicted to drugs who will be addicted to drugs until the day they die. And there's nothing anybody can do to change that. And after a certain point, there's no real valid reason to continue to throw money and effort at that goal. It's a stupid goal. They're never going to be a productive worker, but we don't need them to be a productive worker.
Okay.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of people in rehab who have no intention of living drug-free.
Right.
But they know that if they go through the process, they can stay out of jail. They can maintain the sympathies of their families. You know, basically, society stays off their case as long as periodically they pretend that they intend to get sober.
And I will say that we don't yet know how many of those people fit in even finer grained category. So many of the people, and I've met a few people who eventually died of their addictions, but they say that the addiction is something that helps them get through the life that they're living now. And it was a quote from somebody, and you can probably look it up because I don't remember it. And it's like, the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's community. These people were having trouble fitting into the community that has been created around us. The one with long distance travel and atomized city centers or no city center at all. The ugly architecture, the stupid regimentation of the workforce and the family life. You go back 100 years, it didn't exist. I don't know how many of those people would fit perfectly into a small town America with a vibrant social fabric and built environment that doesn't suck. It would be interesting to find out. But yeah, if we can lower the numbers of people who really just live to die by the needle or the bottle, that would save a lot of money.
You know, particularly when it's the needle, being a junkie is a full-time job.
Yeah.
You know, you have some very unforgiving deadlines a couple times a day, you know, and if you don't meet that deadline, you're really going to pay for it. It's going to be miserable. Mm-hmm. So when you said the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, but it's community, I was thinking, maybe it's purpose.
Well, community provides purpose.
Right.
Being a member of a community is in itself a purpose.
Yeah, you're in the service of a larger entity, something that encompasses you but is larger than you.
That's part of it. You're also surrounded by people who recognize you as a valid part of the society. You have a feeling of inclusion. And we were talking about the whole problem with employment and bullshit jobs. And I can't help but really suspect that this lack of gainful employment and upward mobility in just about every sector of the population, except the extremely wealthy, is the driver behind the addiction problem.
Well, of course, the addiction problem is a complicated beast.
It is. And what's striking to me is we're older. Spoiler. I was talking with a guy at work who's now 30, and he was talking about his friend's little brother, who was 25, and his friend's little brother was in a little league team. And this is complete anecdata. Okay. I don't know how much of it is relevant to the actual statistical reality. He said, out of the 11 guys on that little league team, 7 of them have already died from overdose.
Wow.
And that really hit me because I only know people that drink themselves to death, like, you know, our generation did.
Like normal people.
Thank you. I mean, if you have to go and score your whatever substance from a seedy back alley, you can go into a 7-Eleven and grab beer. I mean, come on. But that would really hit me. And you've, of course, you've read the story of the Ohio drug dealing Fantasyland, Dreamland?
Dreamland, it was a community swimming pool. That
yes,
was sort of symbolic.
That's the one, and it turned into a bad place for the heroin. And that is completely out of my reality.
But, you know, something that is not just an outgrowth of the economic trends of the past 3 decades that contributes to addiction is the efforts of, you know, companies like Purdue Pharma.
The Sacklers.
Yes, and you know, they weren't the only ones. I mean, there was a decades-long push to redefine pain treatment, and, you know, there was this letter that a doctor wrote, and it, you know, it referenced some data, but it wasn't a study. It was just a letter that a doctor wrote to the, I think, the Journal of the AMA.
Yes.
Saying that, you know, I don't see any evidence that people taking opioids for pain management become addicted.
Well, it was specific actually to OxyContin. So he didn't see any evidence of opiate pain management with time release. And I believe Purdue Pharma was the one that hyped that as if it were a study.
Well, there was there was a movement. I mean, there was an ideological base that already believed that. And true, I mean, this is a point they were making, which is absolutely true, is that for decades, people have been suffering needlessly because doctors have been very afraid to prescribe effective pain medication because the DEA would take away their license to prescribe drugs.
Right.
So that was a genuine ongoing harm in our national community.
And yeah, I remember that being a problem for end of life. I mean, who cares if they're addicted?
Exactly. But, you know, we've corrected way too far in the other direction to the point where, you know, they were just handing out heroin basically like it was candy.
And, yeah, oh boy.
And then people discovered that actual heroin is much cheaper than the synthetic stuff.
I have a book just behind me that I haven't read. I heard the author interviewed. It's Alfred McCoy. The book is The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia.
Ooh.
He came up with this in the 1970s, early 1970s, when heroin was being really channeled through the CIA and the military into the United States from Cambodia, Laos, and other places where they grew it. And they tried to shut him down, but he had 600 original sources, and it was too well documented for him to really suffer anything. The problem, it's like, okay, I need to read this. And so, of course, I went to the library website. The only place I could get it was if I went to the reading room at the downtown branch, and I couldn't check it out. And that told me that there is still a war by the intelligence community to have this book suppressed. So every time it's available for checkout, it disappears and it never gets returned. I found a copy just lying around in a free book pile. So one of these days I'm going to read it, but I have discovered because of the COVID, because of the stupid, that I really am not in the mood to read anything that's downer news, even though I know it's important downer news. So I haven't touched it in the 3 years that I picked it up from a pile of a free library thing. And he has a foreword or an afterword, I can't remember, that updates the situation. Afghanistan has become the new Cambodia Laos. And they're, in some cases, literally moving the heroin through pipelines, oil pipelines. They put it in the pigs, and they send it through the pipelines across borders. And the CIA handles the unloading of the pig, and everybody knows what's going on, and that's just the reality. I mean, I don't remember if you remember when Hamid Karzai was the president of Afghanistan, and his brother was the biggest warlord and heroin producer in the nation. Well, now I realize that was connected.
So just for the folks who are not familiar with your pipeline lingo, the pig is not an animal.
It can be after a really bad party.
The pig, though, it's a device that gets put in the pipeline itself to clean it, basically.
To clean it and to separate product. So the same pipeline can move diesel and gasoline, but you don't want them to mix. Right. So they put the pig in between the load of diesel, of aircraft fuel, of whatever, bunker one, bunker two, all the various products that the refineries can produce.
So the pig serves a couple different purposes, and it also transports opiates. But, you know,
yes,
opiates that start in a field with opium poppies, that's so quaint. That's just cute, you know?
Well, I know we can go fentanyl. We can do fentanyl. We can go lab geek on everybody. I don't know what the origin of fentanyl is because I'm not a lab geek. Is that something you're aware of?
The origin? Who invented it and when?
No. Let's say I wanted to make fentanyl in my home. Should I go to Home Depot or to the grocery store for raw material?
There's no way you could make it at home cheaper than you could just buy it from China.
No, that's the point. But I mean, is it an extract of honeysuckle dew, unicorn farts? I have no idea.
I don't either. I
hope
opium
is easy.
Never come in contact with that substance.
Well, I came in contact with it legally, but you know that was a butt scan. Yeah, I didn't feel, I detect a hint of cinnamon. No, nothing like that happened. But with opiate, it's easy. You know, you take this puppies, and, you know, you do magic to it, and out comes heroin.
Yep. I remember I had surgery on my sinuses back around 2009, I guess, and there were complications. I had to spend the night in the hospital, and they put an IV in my arm and a little plunger in my hand. And whenever I wanted to, I could just push that plunger with my thumb and turn the pain off. Just in an instant, the pain was gone. It's like there's literally the off switch to pain. You're in pain 1 second, you push the button, you're not in pain for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can see the appeal.
Yeah, no, those opiates, man, they do the job. Unfortunately, they have been, you know, the off-label use is kill yourself quickly.
If done improperly, yes, this is true. This is true. But yeah, they're a powerful drug. But again, back in the 70s when we were growing up, everyone told us about the mice. They had gathered all these mice and put them into like a city setting, and it's crowded and it's dirty, and all they wanted to do was push the little plunger and kill themselves. Therefore, drugs bad. Yeah. And then somebody decided to follow up on this, like, well, hang on. What if the mice were in a nice place? So they built a nice mouse park, and they still made the drugs available, but only a fraction of the little mice plungered themselves to death. So again, if life were more bearable here in these United States, would we have the same problems?
Certainly not. But here's the thing that I'm determined not to get angry.
Oh, good.
Talking about these things. I mean, not just in this conversation, but in general, because it's so easy to get mad at stuff and it doesn't help. It just makes me miserable. So the thing that is the hardest for me to talk about and not get angry about is the Lords of Tech and their doomsteads in Alaska and New Zealand and their pilots paid to stand by on the runway 24/7 just in case shit collapses tomorrow. The Zuckerbergs can get away.
Yep.
And as Doug Rushkoff pointed out last year, you know, the thing they're worried about is how do you keep the private security loyal when money doesn't mean anything anymore because the whole economy has collapsed?
Right. Can we put exploding collars on them? Yeah. They got that from Battle Royale. It's a Japanese movie. It's fascinating.
It's a good film. A gem. So, yeah, to me, it's not just the Lords of Tech. I mean, they're easy to point out because they tend to be celebrities, more so than, you know, billionaires in other industries. Mm-hmm. But they're also celebrities because they're new money. You know, they're young, to varying degrees, telegenic. You know, from my perspective, they are just sitting here extracting as fast as they can with full knowledge of the damage that they're doing. And their plan is to sit there and keep doing it until the system collapses and they can go live underground in New Zealand for a while.
Right.
To me, anybody who's got a bunker in New Zealand, they should be in prison. You know, unless they live in New Zealand. I mean, if they're a New Zealand citizen and they just love to live underground in their hobbit hole or whatever, fine. But if they live most of the time in the San Francisco Bay Area or, you know, surrounding environs, but they have the pilot on standby, the plane fueled and ready to take off 24/7 so that they can escape when the economic catastrophe, which they knowingly brought on, happens, you know, prison, I think, is not too harsh. Although in general, I don't like prison, and I don't think people who haven't committed violent crimes should be there, no matter how irritated I am with them.
Yes. I had an image. You know that the set of The Lord of the Rings is still in New Zealand,
yes.
The Shire.
It's a tourist attraction, yeah.
Yeah, the Shire is still there. And when you said that, I just had this image of Elon Musk going into the round door of Bilbo's house, and he had actually turned that into the bunker. So every now and again, a tour bus goes by through the sheep field where they built it, and Elon Musk is getting his mail. I hope that doesn't deflect you from your righteous anger, but it just made me chuckle. I agree with you. I don't think it's the Lords of Tech. I don't think it's the Koch brothers. I think it's the fact that a whole bunch of people have over the years agreed that money is not politics. It's part of the economy. The law should not interfere with the economy. We should keep the politicians away from the economy because they don't know what they're doing. In the meantime, the same money has been able to buy the politicians and tell them to keep away from the economy. And there's only one outcome to all of this, and it's been repeated time and time again. You and I, with our silly jobs, get to work harder, and bunker people get to have more bunker. Mm-hmm. And what was the term that was used as a pejorative on Twitter about my about that position?
Class essentialism.
I'm a class essentialist. Okay, there we go. And if you want to expand it, that means a class essentialist is also somebody who wants to look out for the interests of somebody who doesn't have bunker money. So I'm kind of also on the side of a race essentialist, a gender essentialist, a sexual orientation and whatever essentialist. That's all together. It's like class essentialism is actually a good thing because we recognize that bunker is bad.
What's more, if you address if you approach fixing our situation from a class perspective, you are going to disproportionately benefit people of color, women, all the groups that are genuinely marginalized for non-class-based reasons. They're the ones who are going to benefit the most from an effective class-based remedy.
Exactly my point. Exactly my point. Now, I don't know if I should repeat this because it's so good. It's so good. We've been having some trouble here in the greater Seattle area, specifically with the bus service. And it has to do with money and the fact that buses need it. And now that we have COVID, now that we have the plague, we don't charge fares because that would put the rider too close to the driver. In an effort of keeping the drivers alive, they've decided to have everybody board for free in the back. Now, there are still quite a few people who need to ride the bus to get to work, to do whatever. They can't drive. We're getting quite a few people just driving, and a lot of people are telecommuting, so it's not really an issue. Well, when you have an income gap, you get problems. You have to make adjustments. We've cut service. There has been some other difficulties. We've already had two drivers die of COVID. Then there was a call. And the call was from, and I didn't get the names, and the people who were in on the call did not share the names. And since it was only a verbal conversation, there is no written record, so you won't find this anywhere. They wanted to do some layoffs. Okay. They wanted to lay people off. They wanted, though, permission from the union. I don't know if I've mentioned, I'm one of the upper ups in the union, not the whole big upper ups, but like one of the main support guys. So I get this information from the source. They wanted to do the layoffs based on equity, which is, mean? I'm sorry?
What does that mean?
It is a woke term they wanted to fire the white people.
Okay.
So we of course have a seniority-based contractually mandated system. They also said this to the Seattle police. And they're at one point, somebody either the city or county council put forth a movement to make it legal to do so. Now, I'm not thinking, just roll my eyes. I'm not just thinking that. I'm thinking to myself, what will the Red Tribe think of this once it gets out? If this gets out, if it is confirmed, if what passes for a newspaper actually starts to report it in a way that can be verified, 4 more years, baby. 4 more years. That is the trigger for every person who looks at a person of color or ethnicity side-eyed, thinking they're going to take the jobs. I mean, what were the guys in Charlottesville chanting? You will not replace us.
And
they literally wanted to do that here in King County, Seattle.
Yeah, I think the Tiki Torch guys were chanting, Jews will not replace us.
They were doing both.
Oh, okay.
If you watch the whole thing, they alternate between them. Some of the guys were like playing. Some of the guys were saying you clearly, and some of the guys are saying Jews, whatever.
Yeah.
But the fear of Jews, as far as I can tell, is a fear of replacement, which I don't get because, my in-laws are all Jewish and I don't see the appeal. Really? You fear for your jobs from these very fine folks? I mean, they're competent and they're lovely, but yeah.
I think the Jews will not replace us chant is referencing a scenario where the Jews are the masterminds who are bringing in dark-skinned people to replace white workers. They're not, the Jews aren't, you know, there to do the work themselves.
That was something that both Lenin and Hitler believed. It was called the Judeo-Negroid Conspiracy.
Well, it's alive and well.
Okay. I don't think it ever died, actually, but, yeah. You know. Again, we don't travel in the right circles to get this skinny. But yeah,
my point that I want to work around to with that, though, is that really that chant and the belief system that it references just it highlights a lack of imagination and a lack of understanding of what's actually happening, because it's not that white people are being displaced so that dark-skinned people can be given their jobs. I mean, that does happen.
Yes.
Particularly with, you know, in tech, with people coming from primarily from India to replace American workers. But for the most part, it's just that the jobs are going away. They're not being taken by any different human. They just don't exist anymore.
Right. And in the press, in life, they are seeing more dark people. Whereas before, they lived in white bread communities like the suburbs I grew up in. And they don't see the correlation, the causation. They do see a change in their life, and it's not for the better. They're just ascribing the wrong cause. Yes, right. Absolutely. And the more I learned, the more I also learned that the causes I thought were the causes of the thing were more nuanced and subtle, and I have to expand my vocabulary and read another book to figure out what the hell's going on. I wish the library were open. Oh, jeez.
We have interesting adaptations going on here. Like, our library was one of the first things to close, but you can still check out books. You do it online, and they put it in a box out in front of the library, and you just come by and pick it up.
I hope we get to that point. I know they are now at a point where they can accept returns. So I have some returns that I can return, and I just haven't gotten around to doing it. And they will honor holds that were put on hold before the COVID shutdown. So I have a grand total of 2 books waiting for me eventually. Happily, one of them is the second book of The Expanse. So, you know, that'll be good.
All right. A show I enjoy, but not so much that I had to go and read the books and see what happens next.
Well, I mean, the show is up to, I think, book 5. So, you know, you got some reading ahead of you if you want to wait. Yeah, that's a fun one. That's a really good show.
So we've been talking economics and, you know, the stories that get told by people who either don't understand economics or don't want to talk about it.
Right.
How about the election?
Speaking of people who don't understand the economics or don't want to talk about it?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's my chief fear. In fact, I get into arguments with the neighbors with whom we have wonderful relations. In fact, one of them was a former guest on the Sea Realm, as well, you know.
Yes, yes, yes.
And they don't understand my position. It's like, what if Joe wins and nothing changes for the average person in their stuck job and the threat of foreclosure and all of the things that they're facing under Trump? There's no evidence or there's no policy that's come out of the Democratic Party that says we will abandon neoliberalism to help save the people who don't make a crap load of money.
I'm sure the word neoliberalism was not uttered once at the Democratic convention.
What?
Yeah.
They didn't even invoke like Keanu Reeves's character from The Matrix? And the fact that he was a little bit to the blue? Wow, I didn't know that. I'm not surprised. If Joe wins and nothing changes, we have exactly the same situation as when Obama went for 8 years and nothing changed, and a whole bunch of people went to this guy who was campaigning based on populist sentiments. Okay, he was lying through his teeth, but he correctly identified what people were really upset about. And if Joe gets in there and doesn't really do an FDR,
Which he's not going to do.
He's not even going to make the whole healthcare system Bernie-esque. He's just going to kind of maybe, I don't know, make insurance in a different color money. I don't see how this isn't going to lead to the next Trump. And considering the progression of totalitarian tendencies from W to Trump, the next one's going to be really bad.
Yeah. I mean, benefits of Trump. He doesn't understand why he won in 2016. If he did, he would call Steve Bannon today. He would say, come back here, orchestrate my campaign, write my speeches, or, you know, make some notes. Not like Trump's going to read the speech. But he doesn't. He doesn't understand that he won because he actually, possibly accidentally, spoke to the genuine economic concerns of a large portion of the country. You know, this socialism sucks campaign, which they decided to run last year. They didn't even know who the nominee would be. That they decided this is going to be our campaign. It doesn't resonate with anybody.
No.
Except, you know, millionaires.
Right. It resonates with the people that they serve.
Yeah. But not even all the people that they serve. Because I think a lot of the billionaires, particularly, you know, the Wall Street billionaires, maybe the, the defense contractors. I don't think they're so naive as to how economics work or how the country works that, you know, they really believe that the socialism is a danger. I mean, particularly
right.
Defense contractors, really the only danger to their bottom line is that we might stop fighting continuous foreign wars.
That would be a pain, a great pain for them, yes.
Pain in the bottom line, for sure.
Yes. Yeah, the vertical one. I know. It's baffling to me. When I talk to people about things I'm reading that completely do not have anything to do with what's on the 24-hour news cycle or the latest Twitter feed or the fuck book or whatever it is that people are zoomed in on, they just give me the glassy stare because they really don't understand what I'm talking about, like what you and I are kind of talking about now. Do you get that a lot?
I don't talk to a lot of people face-to-face. So.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. Yeah. Yeah.
And also, having sold insurance to the elderly set in Arkansas, I'm pretty good at finding common ground with people and talking to them about things that I know they understand and care about, even if I don't really understand or care about them. And, you know, there's a part of me, a side of me that just, you know, wants to be civil and pleasant. And I pick my battles in terms of, dueling ideologies.
Right. And, well, I think that's one of the issues. I was talking about this with a friend. He's very, very Trump. He just loves the man to death for various reasons. And we're not speaking past each other at all. I'm listening to him, and I throw out some points that he agrees with. And I finally just looked at him and was like, that's my goal, is to be able to speak with anyone and convince them that the thing they hate is actually the way to go. And he kind of got it. But, you know, he's only 30. He's got kids. He's got other thing concerns. You know, he doesn't want the government taking his many, many guns. And I'm telling him, look, what about this? What about this? And it's like, well, there are people who label themselves Democrats that are actually in favor of that. Oh, that's interesting. You know, so you can talk to people constructively. And I don't say walking into somebody's home for coffee and insurance pitch. That's not going to work. You have to do this with people you know well enough that you can get the ground rules. When I took anthropology the first time, the professor said, look, we go in there and we talk about digging sticks. Digging sticks are whatever implement the tribe uses to plant their seeds or fish. And you go, oh, that's really cool web. Where did you get that net? Where did you get that hook? How did you make that? And you talk about their technology. That's step one. You don't get to their religion until you've been there 3 years, if you're lucky. So no, going into a home and having coffee with Jervis and Francine, whatever, you're not going to get into the finer points of Steve Keen's takedown of economics in his book, Debunking Economics. You know, you're not going to talk about Matt Stoller's theory of monopolism. You're not going to use the neoliberal word. Oh, that's right. They didn't use the word neoliberal. Oh, you're right. So I guess that's what I'm really frustrated about. There's no place where you can go and have a deep conversation with a candidate, really anywhere. They know that they have this screen of media protecting them from the hard questions and the hard answers.
Right now, I'm seeing the Republicans and the Democrats as, you know, partners in a game of good cop, bad cop.
Hmm.
And if you understand how the game works, you know, the good cop, bad cop game, and you just want to demonstrate to the police that, you know, I'm not having it, who do you punch in the nose, the good cop or the bad cop? From my perspective, you punch the good cop in the nose. Because he's not on your side. He's just playing a role. You know, if you punch the good cop in the nose, well, you're going to get your ass kicked for one. But if you reject, you know, the feigned concern and help from the good cop and say, look, you're a cop, you're not on my side, go to hell.
Right.
That's way more effective than saying that to the bad cop.
Yeah.
So I put up a video a couple weeks ago. Actually, it was the day that the Biden campaign announced Kamala Harris as VP.
You mean the former prosecutor at a time when people are protesting the use of police in ineffectual and overreaching ways?
That's the one. And I put up a video saying, Kamala Harris, really? Okay, I'm voting for Trump. And, you know, of course, got indignant replies. I also got replies that surprised me. Like, people that I've been hearing from for years said, yeah, you know what? Me too. And it's like, that wasn't really my objective.
Damn it.
Making this video. And in fact, I didn't vow to vote for Trump. You know, I just said I'm voting for Trump in a video title. And, you know, it worked. It got more attention than my normal videos. But from my perspective, now that the Democrats, you know, the Obama Democrats, have put a knife through the heart of, you know, the progressive left and thrown them to the ground, pissed on them, I cannot understand why anybody who doesn't want, you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and would prefer, you know, Andrew Yang, Tulsi Gabbard, Bernie Sanders, what you think you're going to get by cozying up to the good cop now.
Well, and let's remember that the knife that Barack Obama used, if you look very carefully at the handle, it says Bill. So, I mean, he got everything he knew from Clinton.
Oh,
he just sharpened it.
Yeah.
And this has been happening for a long time. Joe is just going to be the next guy to hold the Bill knife.
Joe is going to be an empty suit. He will have nothing to do with, you know, the goals, the direction, the methodology of his own administration.
Well, someone will hold the Bill knife.
Yeah.
Maybe Bill will. I don't know.
No. I think Bill's main job at this point is to stay out of prison.
Out of prison and maybe to keep the zipper intact. I don't know. I don't know what... The other thing is, the good cop, bad cop analogy is a good one for when you're under arrest and being interrogated. And sadly, that's not the case here. But, you know, we don't have to punch anybody in the nose. We just have to not watch the conventions. And that data point really doesn't bleed into their metrics. We're just the disinterested, disgusted, cynical old guys. And they don't even try to reach out to us.
Guilty, yes.
Yeah, they don't even try to reach out to the disinterested, cynical old guys.
Well, when I put up a video saying I'm voting for Trump, they at least try to shame me and scold me.
Sure. I mean, they can do that. I mean, it's pretty easy with, I mean, YouTube's kind of a sewer anyway.
Yep.
You might be interested in this. I don't know if you are or not, but my brother is a computer guy, and he has a friend, also a computer guy, who was commissioned to write a piece of software by somebody called a griefer. Have you heard the term?
I have heard the term, yeah.
Okay. Well, this griefer wanted to be able to put negative reviews on people's YouTube videos that if he clicked once, 1,000 negative reviews go onto the video.
So are these procedurally generated based on a transcript of the video, or?
I don't know. I don't know the exact details, but it was like 1,000 different bad reviews hit that video over time. And the developer of the software said, it's like, you know, if you want, you can also rate things good that way.
No.
And the guy literally said, that's not going to happen. So this is where he lives, is on YouTube griefing on videos. I don't feel the pull toward that particular venue. That's just me. I applaud your pluck and verve.
Well, it's not just you, because the vast majority of the Sea Realm podcast listening audience does not follow my YouTube output.
Okay, good to hear.
Yep,
I have dipped a toe, and I've watched several. You do a better job than most YouTube videos I see. And really, the only time I go looking for YouTube videos is when I hear about somebody who did a speech somewhere, and I want to get that, or somebody put up something from C-SPAN, or I need to fix my dishwasher.
Yeah, with me, it's figuring out how to actually operate the software that I, you know, I depend on to do my job.
Oh, dear.
When I don't know something, I go to YouTube.
Well, that's right. You probably have newer software.
I do. I mean, I do a lot of, visual art as well.
Yes. You're a comic, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah. And other things. And I have to specify, it's not my comic. I write it. I draw it. I created the characters, but they do not belong to me.
Good enough.
Yeah.
You still do a fine job. I will say that.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, there was talk before we got on the line here of a cheat sheet that you were going to make. And I, for the life of me, can't bring to mind what topic that cheat sheet was going to serve.
Oh.
All right, everybody. That's an hour. I will play the rest of this conversation on an upcoming podcast. Talk to you again soon. Stay well.